now I would like to ask our State Board Representative and Liaison, Mr. Steve Moore, to give us an update. Thank you very much, and as always, welcome.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Wolf and board members, and thanks for this opportunity to brief you on activities of the State Water Board to the great Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. My name is Stephen Moore. I'm on the State Water Resources Control Board and the liaison to this region, and appreciate the opportunity to update you. As you can imagine, there's a lot of things going on, and we could go on and on, and I want to respect your time and those of the folks in the room, but also try to give you some highlights of things that would be of particular interest to you as members of the Central Coast Regional Board. Last time we talked a little bit about a very active period in the State Water Board's history in terms of two amendments to the Ocean Plan on desalination and trash control, a landmark regulation adopted on May 5th for urban water conservation, and the tiers of required water conservation targets that are mandatory and enforceable for 411 water purveyors around the state, and then also for the other several thousand purveyors of water, certain requirements have to be met. Well, I can say on that topic, today at about 10:30, I think, there will be a press event to discuss the first month of data that has come in on water use around the state. And the soundbite that is good news is that as a state, we successfully reduced our consumption of water in urban areas by 27.3%. And the governor's executive order required 25%. So as a state, we successfully met the target of June 2015 use compared to June 2013 use of reducing by 25% or more. So there will be more detail on that to come. And you know, I want to congratulate all Californians and really the folks here in the Central Coast region who take this challenge very seriously, and it shows in the numbers that we've received. Other recent activities, last time in May, we went into some detail about trailer bill language that was being considered and answered some questions about, there are good 8 or 9 different bins of new authorities that are being either at local level or at the state level to deal with drought emergency. Earlier this week, I gave a detailed presentation and question and answer session to the board of directors of the East Bay Municipal Utility District. They had some very pointed questions for me related to, from a large water service provider, concerns about these authorities. Specifically, SB 83 gives the state board and its drinking water division a fee authority to basically pay for the staff of our drinking water division and its district offices and the state water board office. And the fact that federal subsidy for this safe drinking water program in our state is going away, and we have to make the have fiscal solvency in our program in terms of paying for staff and benefits, and also paying for things like drought response and regulation development and implementation and enforcement. For instance, you know, as we've talked about, there's 22 communities now that are under a moratorium using drinking water division authority, a moratorium for connecting water service. And this isn't related to the Carmel River situation, that kind of thing. This is just that the water rights do not support a more junior water right diversion. It's not as much of an issue here in the Central Coast region where groundwater is the main source of drinking water, but certain communities, they may even have fairly senior water rights, but because of the lack of water availability, they don't have the right to divert, and therefore there's a public health issue. And that's why the moratorium kicked in last October for 22 communities. In informal consultation with our deputy director of drinking water, she indicates to me we may be looking at more like 100 communities as this drought emergency unfolds through the summer. And so there'll be more to come in terms of just water availability and public health. So yes, we need to have fees to support that. And it's tough because there's going to be a stepwise increase that's authorized under these emergency regulations. And then we've committed to rounding it out to a maximum of 5% fee increases in years going forward. But that stepwise increase could be 17% or more. And that hits home for our local agencies, and we need to keep working with them. Another important tool in our toolbox that has been added was SB 88 in the trailer bill language. This gives the State Water Board and its Drinking Water Division authority to, in certain very specific circumstances, order the consolidation of water agencies. We have, and this, the way that the language in the trailer bill was worded, it was some concern with water agencies that could be more broadly interpreted than its intent. You know, the intent here really is, and it's in the statute, and there's about 12 to 15 pages of statutory language. It's very detailed about the circumstances under which the State Water Board would exercise this authority and the process it would go through to do so. And so there are many constraints on that. The bottom line is this: the purpose of this authority is to provide safe, affordable, accessible drinking water to disadvantaged communities. And this is a tool that we intend to exercise judiciously and in cooperation with local entities to give that little extra nudge where a community might be adjacent or even within a service boundary of maybe a larger agency, a city, water district. And this will provide not only the direction to consolidate, but more importantly, funding to go through the LAFCO process, funding to do any infrastructure upgrades or extensions, funding for staffing to a certain degree. All those details will be worked out. So we're enthusiastic about a new tool to be able to help communities in our state get safe drinking water. That's the intent, and there may be cleanup language that follows to make that intent more clearly evident to those who would be concerned that we would, you know, expand this into a broader consolidation effort, which is not our intent, and it's not the intent of our drinking water division. So there's a couple of pretty interesting developments. You know, along the lines of the drought, I do want to acknowledge Lisa McCann's efforts and, you know, her regular reports on the drought. Coordination with our Division of Water Rights. They're nice, they're brief reports and easy to read and accurate, and so I appreciate that. Interestingly, you know, I talked a little bit about the curtailment issue and the water rights. That's not really the big deal here on the Central Coast region. The big deal here is Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. And there have been many activities, and I hope to give this or give you just a brief snapshot and encourage you to get involved in these processes if it is of interest to you. And same for our members of our audience here today. Basically, three things I'd like to point out on SGMA is what we call it. Sustainable Groundwater Management Act is SGMA. So now you know that's the code word. First, there's draft basin boundary changes regulation. That is regulations under which local entities can change the basin boundaries of groundwater basins to update Bulletin 118, which this process is overseen by our sister agency, Department of Water Resources. These draft regulations are on the street. There's an internal comment deadline we've established within the water boards. You met the gentleman here last time in May. His name's Thomas Peltier. He works for Eric Ekdahl in our Sustainable Groundwater Unit. We're asking that internal comments go to him if you're interested in pursuing that process by August 20th on the draft regulations. Public comment is due on these draft regulations by September 4th. There will be a meeting at the Cal EPA building where we meet on August 31st from 10 to 12 in the morning. And there's also two other meetings, public meetings, in advance of the comment deadline. One is on September 2nd from 4 to 6 in the evening in Bakersfield at the Bakersfield Community College. And the next day in Santa Ana, California, on September 3rd from 1 to 3 in the afternoon. By January 1st, DWR is required by statute to adopt these regulations. There's two change requests that are contemplated in the draft regulations, both geared toward the more effective, sustainable management of groundwater resources. So there's two change requests that can be made to the current map in Bulletin 118. One is based on scientific information, just new mapping, new data on subsurface conditions and that sort of thing. And so that's scientific, number one. And number two, jurisdictional. So in cases where it makes sense to manage the resource more sustainably based on geopolitical boundary or other considerations, that can be used to justify. Now, I think you all know, from where I'm coming from, I think we need to really respect the water cycle and try to make these boundaries as scientifically based as possible for long-term sustainability, avoiding conflict and that sort of thing. But there are certain places where the boundary just is not crisp enough on the surface, and geopolitical considerations may be warranted. And we see that a lot in the Central Valley. I don't have an example right at the top of my head here in your region, but I'm sure you can think of some. So that was the first activity under SGMA. The second activity under SGMA is Groundwater Sustainability Plan Regulation Development, the GSP, the Groundwater Sustainability Plan. It's sort of the new groundwater management plan that takes into account things like surface water interaction and updated information. So that's currently under development. That's a longer term deadline under the new law. And public meetings are being undertaken now and have webcasts. There was a meeting on July 20th. The next meeting will be on August 27th. And there'll be another meeting on September 21st in terms of just getting public input, stakeholder input, technical input on groundwater sustainability plan regulation development. DWR is heading this, but we are very closely involved in this process. As you can imagine, the State Water Board takes this very seriously. And so I encourage you to use our website to find out the location and timing of those meetings if you're interested. Third, this next month, DWR will announce 9 additional groundwater basins in California that will be considered officially in critical overdraft. 9 basins. 4 of them are in your region. The last time the list of critically overdrafted basins was updated was, do you know the answer? 1980. So a lot's happened since then, as you know. And so there are going to be 9 additional basins, 4 of which will be in this region. But since the announcement date was August, I'm honoring the request of the DWR not to reveal the names of those basins publicly at this time. One kind of related item is the April 1st executive order from Governor Brown requires all groundwater basins that are high or medium priority, and there are 127 of these basins around the state, to comply with the CASGEM requirements. So while it was voluntary before the executive order, now these data must be submitted. And so that's relevant to a lot of places in this region. Chair Wolf mentioned that coming up there's the wetlands meeting, and it's an outgrowth of the Water Quality Coordinating Committee which is the annual meeting of regional board members and the state board members, where we gather and talk about current topics of interest. This year's Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting will be October 12th and 13th, Monday and Tuesday, at the Cal EPA building in Sacramento. We'll be focusing the first day, a good part of it, on the groundwater management issues and the whole range of aspects involved with that, SGMA, but also other issues like recycled water use and recharge and that sort of thing. It goes on and on. Water rights with groundwater, a lot of complexity. So we're giving ourselves a good three and a half hours to dig into groundwater. And the next day we'll talk about the drought and how it's affecting regional board workload. And we're going to talk about the Stormwater Strategic Initiative, which we have a board meeting coming up on August 19th, the Wednesday, where we're going to discuss that statewide initiative, where we've had substantial contributions from your staff on sort of the more phase two lens, the smaller cities lens on stormwater management, and here with the groundwater interaction. And then finally, we'll wrap up with the wetlands issue. Now, what is this wetlands restoration issue? Well, I would give a lot of credit to San Diego region. Their executive officer is a biologist, but a good thinker, and then their chair was interested in developing an action plan around wetland restoration. And I was approached with the idea, and I saw the value of all of us putting effort into this, because if we are successful in having a real net gain of wetland functions around the state, we will be addressing many, many water resource issues, and we'll be using many of our regulatory and funding tools in creative ways, leveraging, partnering, but working together to have an outcome of our efforts that isn't really just permits issued or inspections conducted or enforcement actions taken, those kind of outputs, but more wetland acreage gained, functions provided, carbon taken out of the atmosphere, other outcomes that we all care about and want to see happen. And maybe we can do a better job tracking and do a better job taking credit and showing the public we're getting this work done. So in that spirit, it's kind of a new idea to use the WQCC to work together as regional boards and the state board to come up with an action plan and say we're going to focus on wetland restoration, net gain of wetlands functions and variety of wetlands, and all the pollution control benefits they give us, the habitat benefits, and we're going to track that. So that's the idea, and we've been refining it with our meetings and that Chair Wolf mentioned, and we're going to meet this Monday and learn from the scientists about monitoring techniques to help us track wetland gain in our state and collectively take credit for those efforts that don't easily translate to work plan type outputs. So I hope that puts a little lens on it. It's something we all care about, but sometimes we have a hard time explaining how much we've been successful doing it in terms of more streams restored, more wetlands restored, more coastal estuaries, better water quality. Coming up this Tuesday, so that's on, we're going to meet face-to-face from 10 to 3. We're even going to talk about Governor Pete Wilson's old 1993 executive order. We're going to look at that in some detail and ask ourselves, does it make sense to propose to our current governor an updated executive order for wetland restoration? It's not just no net loss, but much net gain. Something we're going to talk about. We may have what we need with the current order. We'll see. Then the next day, we have a state water board meeting. And at that hearing, we'll take up a general waste discharge requirements for composting facilities that would have statewide applicability. This would be a tool that the regional boards can use to regulate composting facilities to protect mostly groundwater. These facilities are already covered under the industrial stormwater permit in terms of the surface water runoff from composting facilities. This would be specifically to protecting the groundwater from pollutants as the composting operation goes. Final compost, as we all know, or should know, doesn't cause pollution. In fact, we use it in stormwater engineering, you know, in terms of treatment. So compost material we know is good, but when you're making it, we want to make sure that we don't cause a problem that we would regret later. We want to acknowledge your staff, Taya Tryon. She attended the hearing, the workshop last month in June, where we heard 4.5 hours of testimony on this general order. We're trying to find that right balance where we protect groundwater, but we don't create a regulatory system that has a disincentive to composting, because we all know it's really wonderful. In fact, I sat there for 4.5 hours and heard about how wonderful composting is. I don't argue with that.
Steve, yes. quick question on that. On the composting, on this new proposed set of guidelines, it includes also food waste composting? Because I know, you know, there's a big difference between green waste composting and food as it relates to, you know, health effects in that particular aspect.
Yes, that's right. There's, within the details of the order, those factors are taken into account. There's a tiering of the type of compost material. The higher tier has a higher threat with, you know, and there's a certain amount of additive that's allowed. 10% can also have some manure, but you wouldn't want a manure-dominated product in certain settings. So it gives, I think, the regional boards in their implementation will be able to use this as a general framework to make sure to head off higher strength and higher threat type operations. That's an important point. There are very many nuances to the management issue. That's why it's been being worked on for about 4 years, and we updated the CEQA analysis to deal with some of the economic aspects as well. It's expected, you know, and I acknowledge that the growth of composting is going to be very large. We hear in the record of this proceeding on the order of 75 to 100 new facilities of a magnitude that would be regulated under this general order. And that's significant. And so with that, from a water protection standpoint, we want to make sure these new facilities are designed correctly. But, you know, we respect the viewpoint that not one size fits all in all settings, and we don't want to create a financial disincentive for composting. There's a concern about an unintended consequence of illegal land application of compost material if we have too onerous of a program. So that's part of the dialogue and the back and forth.
When you say growth, anticipated growth of 75 to 150, are you talking about as part of municipal infrastructure at that level?
Yes, it would be part of that. Okay. And this is because of the Cal Recycle requirements. I should have been more clear, but our sister agency in Cal EPA has certain mandates on municipalities to divert compostable material from the waste stream. Well, that has to go somewhere and be processed. So that's been part of the challenge and in dialogue is with Cal Recycle is figuring out what's the right level, what's the light enough touch on this that doesn't interfere with our important solid waste management goals. So that's a very interesting issue. You know, I've talked to some legislators about it, and I have to bring up the example of, you know, cross-media unintended consequences, and I bring up the example of MTBE, where that was an additive to gasoline that helped air quality, and so air quality dominated the discussion in terms of its widespread incorporation into fuel. Well, the unintended consequence was of widespread contamination of groundwater resources that we are still working on cleaning up, and a very costly unintended consequence. We want to try to avoid those kind of situations and cross-media unintended consequences. So it's, like I say, it's been pretty busy. We've been, our drinking water folks have been providing emergency drinking water funding around the state and in response to the drought. Here in this region, in the last month or two, there was $121,000 made available to, and I always get, is it Oceano, Community Services District here in San Luis Obispo County for well rehabilitation in with respect to the drought. We talked a little bit about some of the other drinking water last time. The Clean Beaches Initiative is still out there. There's about $25 million still remaining in this Clean Beaches Initiative grant program. There are a few projects in preparation, not yet executed, but one's here in this region, in Santa Cruz County. There's almost a $2 million grant to the Sanitation District in Santa Cruz County for the Soquel Pump Station Force Main Repair Project, which would improve water quality at Capitola Beach. And so we're trying to improve infrastructure where we have the opportunities. Also on this upcoming meeting, we're, for those that are familiar with the statewide industrial general permit for stormwater, we are extending a deadline. We adopted the permit last year, July 1st, it's supposed to kick into gear and data start to be submitted. We had technical difficulties with the SMART system. I guess the SMART system was not as smart as it should be. And so we're extending the deadline for our industrial stormwater enrollees to be able to submit their information by August 14th. Is anyone here familiar with the Carmel River Eastwood license issue with water rights? You've heard about this? On July 3rd, the Division of Water Rights issued our decision 2015-01, which is the first one. Which approved a split of a water right license of the Clint Eastwood Trust in the Lower Carmel River watershed. The license was split to create two water right licenses. One was for a dedication of 0.08 CFS to water and in-stream flows to the Carmel River. And two was to allow for water that was previously used for irrigation to be used for municipal purposes and diverted at new points of diversion. So this is a complicated project, but as part of the package, and I always like to people to think of things as a package. That's my style. You know, what's the deal? You know, what's the overall deal? Okay, we're going to put some water in the river. You were using some water for irrigation. You want to help out the community, you know, with the Carmel River straitjacket as they're going through, and even Board Member Delgado touched on some of those activities. So what's the overall package? Well, that land is actually adjacent to and formerly part of the Carmel River floodplain. And so in dedicating the land for coastal estuarine restoration and floodplain restoration, you have an overall package deal that is, you know, in our mind, beneficial to the public. And so we were involved with some of the details going back and forth. In the end, our Deputy Director of Water Rights signed the document, but you can bet the State Water Board members were involved in this. And so our fingerprints are on it. I stand by it. And I'm glad to be able to visit in 20 years this new beautiful restoration of an estuary and take my kids and grandkids there. Okay, talked about that. There's just a lot of interest, you know, and acceleration really in the idea of using recycled water as a potable water source. We had in June, an expert panel on indirect potable reuse with surface water augmentation and the feasibility of direct potable reuse of wastewater. And so we're really drilling down on this. We're looking at the examination of the feasibility of developing criteria for direct potable reuse. And we're continuing discussions about the feasibility of criteria that include the use of bioanalytical screening methods for contaminant detection, and there have been updates from this pilot demonstration facility in San Diego. So we have on our website information from this panel's discussion posted, PowerPoint presentations and that sort of thing, in terms of the progress on direct potable reuse. So it continues to be of great interest throughout the state, and I know here. Another, finally, I know this board is interested in the harmful algal bloom issue. And there's, as we've talked about a little bit, in the Klamath River, we've had more acute issues there dealing with our Native American communities. And but also one of the, and then in the Delta too, the San Joaquin Sacramento Delta. But Clear Lake, if you've ever been to Clear Lake or know where that is, it's sort of in the coastal range. It drains toward the Central Valley, but it's kind of, it feels like a North Coast place. And there was a June 18th workshop that our Division of Drinking Water Mendocino District held on harmful algal blooms up at Clear Lake. And so there's some, or US EPA was involved with this discussion. And I thought that this workshop represented kind of the current understanding of the science of the microcystins and the cylindrosmirmops type cyanotoxins. And the EPA and its nutrient policy guidelines and recommendations has some resources online if you're interested in learning more. They were discussed at the workshop. Covered a range of topics relating to harmful algal blooms and associated treatment challenges. The goal was to introduce water systems to resources and potential partners in coping with the harmful algal blooms. And there were speakers there from Native American tribes and Lake County public health officers. US EPA was involved, the California Water Service Company. There was a civil engineering professor from Akron, Ohio. And so I thought our staff at Drinking Water Division really pulled together a, kind of a blue ribbon type workshop. And this was on June 18th. So if you want to learn more about that, as I certainly do, which, you know, in my spare time I get up to speed on this, but I think it's going to be an issue we're going to be grappling with more and more and want to get in front of the harmful algal bloom issue. It has, as you know, downstream effects on the marine ecosystem, including the health of our sea otter population. And thank you for the time. There's so much more I could talk about. I'm sorry if I skipped anything you're interested in, but certainly appreciate your efforts. I know Dr. Hunter, you're gonna be speaking, I think, on August 18th at Public Policy Institute of California, you know, something about meeting the challenges of water on the Central Coast. I thank you for your participation in that. I really think PPIC has been a good objective leader, a thought leader in our state on the water issues. I really have a lot of trust in their work, so I'm glad you're participating in that. With that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Moore, thank you for your comprehensive report. Always enjoyable to listen to what you have to share with us. I have a few follow-up questions for you. Out of curiosity, the impact we see from the harmful algal blooms, is this related to both nutrients and flow, or are we seeing this in areas where there is, as you mentioned, Clear Lake? So is it enclosed bodies of water where the amount of water available is not really an issue, but it's from inputs from nutrients? What drives this mostly?
I think you're on the right track. You know, I think both have a something to do with it, because, and then, you know, in the case of where you have impoundments in the Klamath River, that's exacerbated the process of selecting for cyanobacteria instead of other algae. It's a lot of complexity, but flow plays a big role. You know, in diversion of water, then if there's less movement and higher residence time, the algal doubling time, you know, can be met within the residence time of a certain parcel of water. And then you may select, because of the cocktail of different nutrients, you may select more for the cyanobacteria than for the less harmful, you know, chlorophytes and that sort of thing. So it's complex, but I think it does have to do with inputs, and the nutrient management efforts, I think, are a big part of the dial we can turn to try to minimize the impact.
So are the water boards more involved with this in terms of the water quality impacts? In other words, we've got a degradation of beneficial uses. We don't really have a discharge of anything, but we might have a reduction in flow into the system. not something we typically get our hands around.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
It's almost like looking at saltwater, seawater intrusion, where we're concerned about that as an impact to water quality.
Yeah.
But we don't really have a good handle on that as a regional board.
Yeah.
What's the North Coast Regional Board doing, if anything, with the Klamath?
Yeah, I think you've touched on it. It requires collaboration between the regional board and its authorities under TMDL, non-point source implementation, maybe some agricultural programs. Maybe some the septic system management and that sort of thing, the non-point source. So that's the regional board side. And in Klamath, the TMDL is the main implementing tool. And then you have the water rights division and diversions of water. And ultimately, what is in our California Water Action Plan is a commitment to look at in-stream flows for public trust. You know, in the end, for the system to be sustainable, it's fairly, and this is what our executive director, Tom Howard, testified to the legislature last month. The big question is, well, how can we make our system more sustainable? And, you set up what is the public trust flows you need to prevent things like microcisterns. And then you set up an adjudication for the human uses. Based on the history, the seniority, and all that important issues with water rights, and then you have a water master. You have someone who's in charge, local, that keeps track of this, and then finally you have a system measuring and reporting, so that you know if you're meeting those endpoints and everybody gets the water they're entitled to, and you don't cause unintended consequences like algal blooms that make you sick when you go swimming. So to get that system up and running in our state is non-trivial, and it works in some areas, but we have challenges all over the state. And I'm worried that if we don't get ahead of the algal bloom issue, it will come back and cause emergency expenditures and health issues that we'll regret.
Okay. Thank you. On the 22 communities that I think you mentioned have some type of is it a hookup ban on water supply? So I take it these are, this is not ag, this is residences. There's public water systems, and people are being prevented who have property mm-hmm. from actually getting a hookup to the public water system. Is that what's happening? And it may go up to 100 communities?
Right, that's correct. These are public water systems that serve residences, for the most part. I think they're community water system. I don't think they're the non-transient type, the summer camp type thing.
Yeah, actually, probably the biggest one was the one that's east of Mount Diablo. Is it Oakhurst? It's a community of about 15,000 people who came within days of running out of water.
Or is it Mountain House, maybe?
Mountain House, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And the state board brokered a deal with an irrigation district to sell water to the community.
Yeah, that was a dramatic example. And there's a few, they tend to be smaller, but there's a few larger ones. There's a Calaveras Public Utilities District has a few little towns. They're on a moratorium. What was tricky in their case, and we haven't completely resolved it, but we were, as a part of these moratorium orders, we required a planning study, a capacity expansion type study. They uncovered a more senior water right, a pre-1914, but because of the scarcity of water in the San Joaquin Basin this year, even that pre-1914 right, there's not enough quantity of water to support. And so it's just, we're really, this drought is so historic, it's showing real cracks in the system in these areas. But yes, it is a moratorium for connections until a backup supply of water can be identified.
Okay. And then is there, I haven't read anything, and I read all of the headlines that we get out of the State Water Boards. Is it the LIRIS service?
Mm-hmm.
whatever we get from you guys, which is an incredible read to actually see how things are changing sometimes day to day or week to week. But is there any talk about Plan B at all? Haven't heard anything about Plan B, but let's just say that things just kind of continue with the amount of rainfall we've had, the climate patterns we have now, and the lack of normal snowpack. Any talk behind closed doors about what is Plan B for the state?
Well, there's talk behind closed doors, out in the open, you know, here. You know, the Plan B, I mean, yeah, I get, you know, what do we do if in case what we're doing isn't working, right? We look at in terms of short term and long term, right? And so the short term, we talk about, you know, getting emergency drink water to folks. Long term, working with folks using the Prop 1 funding and other things to really, you know, try to create infrastructure solutions, other management arrangements, that sort of thing. You know, look at stormwater as a resource, you know, get things built, recycle water, accelerate those schedules, the more of a long-term response. In the end, we have these tools. So what you're seeing is, if you look at the actual data about water use, you know, whether it's urban use, so we got 27% reduction, the amount of water we've saved over 1 year is coming close to 1 million acre feet. That's real water, as the water buffaloes say. We've saved 1 million acre feet. You know, those the think tank folks who say don't bother with urban because agriculture uses 80% of human use. Well, they're wrong. Bother with urban because you can save 1 million acre feet if you bother with it. You know, so we are now culturally, as Californians, shifting into our action plan number one, which is conservation is a way of life. We're managing the demand. Demand is being forcefully managed uncomfortably with agriculture because of the water rights system priority and the curtailments that are occurring. So there's millions of acre feet that have been cut from their use. And so through the drought process, and then the environment has suffered tremendously. There's been 650,000 acre feet taken out of water flows in the Central Valley, as an example. That's real water as well in terms of relative to the environmental requirements. And we are at the cusp, we're on the cutting edge of managing salinity in the Delta as a result of this. So there's a consequence to these not following the environmental rules that could affect our water supply too. So, you know, by learning through this crisis process, we're learning what we're capable of. And it's going to be a mixture of supply management, investment in storage, groundwater management, groundwater 10 times more potential storage in groundwater than surface water. And you know, by making those corrections, investments, correcting our demand, together supply and demand, tracking more sustainably over time. So use the drought, learn the lessons, quantify it, and keep track of what's going on, and assume no snowpack next year.
So let me ask it this way a little bit. Is there any talk about actually telling people what they can and can't do with water and defining what is an unreasonable use? And I'll give you two examples. Not having green lawns. I mean, having a lawn is just going to be something that is an unreasonable use of water. It's wasteful. Period. Haven't seen that yet. I mean, I've just seen a tremendous ratcheting up of the cost for water and another example being, and it's not to pick on ag, but sometimes you see aerial application or, you know, spraying of water. I had someone tell me that they were, you know, driving up to Salinas and they said, can you believe it? They're still applying water through misting or spraying or sprinklers. And, you know, a certain amount of water is lost that way to evaporation almost immediately. Mm-hmm. Is there discussion about going to the next step, which is to actually start to define what's reasonable, what's not reasonable, what's wasteful?
Well, I think that's implicit in the work we've done this year, and you're seeing it manifest in the implementation of the urban conservation regulations is one example. So you do see the browning lawns. You do see the locals saying you can't water about twice a week. And we have that oversight to make sure that happens. So you're going to see the landscape around you change. And when you see green, it's going to be jarring. But the golf courses is an example. We have a deal with them. You know, it was all in the public. They're going to cut by 25%, just like everybody else. And they have. The fairways and the greens are still green, but the rough is brown. And any golf course you go to in this state. And so there's an implicit recognition of what's wasteful within these very challenging reductions that are required and enforceable, and there will be fines. There will be pain coming up. There's 240 out of 400 met the target. And then we've got an enforcement strategy to deal with the remainder and try to get everyone to meet, because we've got shrinking reservoirs, no snowpack, and that sort of thing. On the agricultural side, much has been learned and implemented. You know, I think it's reasonable to say about half of the farms in our state today are on drip irrigation. So your last question, well, what about the other half? They're working on it. They're taking advantage of funding through the USDA. You know, and I see nothing but progress in this area, you know, because in the end, as you point out, the costs are going up for water. So there's already an incentive for our agricultural community to be more efficient. I think you'll just over time see less of the sprinkler type irrigation when a drip system would suffice.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Morin. Always appreciate your effort to keep us informed of some of the most exciting work, frankly, you know, finally seeing some serious consideration of long-term conservation strategies and a lot of support for it. Mm-hmm. So that counts for a lot. I think the public has, as you note. You said a couple of things. I'm just gonna chime in with a couple of things you were reporting on. And you mentioned the Eastwood Water Rights Agreement. I'm so glad to hear that, but I also wanted to add to the acknowledgments the work of the Big Sur Land Trust, which started that process a decade ago. Great. In looking at the potential and working with Caltrans as well to redo the highway bridge, their Highway 1 bridge, mm-hmm. which was another huge component of that. And so it was part of the work going on at that time, and it was a major, major effort to bring those big agencies into the picture. So I'm delighted to hear that these actions have finally come to fruition. And finally, I think when you were talking about wetlands, you reminded me of one of my personal heroes, if you will, Peter Douglas, who was with us for a long time and all his work with the Coastal Commission. And every time I heard him speak, mm-hmm. he would always, at some point, he would say, "It's so hard to demonstrate the success of the work that we do when you're looking at the beauty of a natural landscape." And often, those are the hardest areas to protect, to conserve, and to maintain, and to sustain over time, and to recognize the ecological functioning and the benefits of that. That is very hard. That's a tough sell. And we've managed to do it in California, and I know I travel around the country, and mm-hmm. we're admired for it. But we've paid a price for it as well. And to some people, it's a good thing. To other people, it's maybe questionable. But I think in looking at wetlands, I believe we've lost 90% of our estuaries. We've lost marshland. So what is remaining has tremendous value. And so I'm really delighted to know that there's an opportunity coming up where we can all get better informed. There's so much more we know now, technology-wise, and so forth. So that's exciting. So look forward to that.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about SB 88 in terms of, I understand that as a consolidation of different water agencies or the potential of that, mm-hmm. But we have this situation over in the valley in East Porterville where it's an unincorporated area, disadvantaged community, but not part of any system. And so I know that a possible solution for them has been to be sort of annexed into Porterville proper, so the city there. But moving forward, and still, I know that they're still formulating some of the funding for that's available for disadvantaged communities. But in that situation where it's individual private wells that have gone dry, but definitely need some immediate relief, is this a tool also available for them?
Yes, thank you, Board Member Cervantes. It's really a good example of why our Deputy Director of Drinking Water recommended this legislation. This really came out of, it's real interesting. So yes, to answer your question, absolutely. This is a tool for that scenario, and to make the tool effective, work with the local Drinking Water Division staff. If they're not already aware of specifics, which they tend to be aware, actually, they know about the data, they know about these water availability issues. And so I'm pleased to let you know, I just reviewed the first three letters written under this new authority day before yesterday. I provided some suggested language in the letter, but it's going to three communities, and they happen to be in the geographic area you mentioned. And there's a process that then gets underway. And like I said, it's not just, you know, thou shalt consolidate. There's a process then that gets started. And we recognize and respect that it's a complex process. There's LAFCO involved. There's funding needed to do the proper studies and processes. And we're doing everything we can to bring that funding to be solutions in these areas. So Porterville's one of our areas, and there will be more.
Well, thank you.
Oh, I have a question.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
A couple of questions. You mentioned that there are nine new basins in critical overdraft, four of them in our area, and I understand the need to keep those quiet until it's public. But currently, most of them, if not all, are in the Central Valley. But I just wanted to confirm, do we have any in our region now that are in critical overdraft?
Mm-hmm. So four.
No, I thought you said four of the
yes,
new ones would be.
Yes, there are four in this region.
Okay, I thought he said that of the nine new that are not publicly disclosed, four will be in our region. Okay, mm-hmm. I get that. My question is, of those that currently exist back from 1990, are any in our area?
Yeah, I don't know the answer.
Yes, I think, for example, Salinas. Salinas has been critical overdraft for years. I think that's one that's designated. There
so
might be one that are currently designated
since
critical.
The 1990 list,
yes.
Was the last time.
1980.
1980, right. Yeah. I've been looking on the internet, and it appears that there's nothing in our area on the maps showing critical overdraft basins currently since 1980. So is it confirmed, Ken, that
I can confirm that, but I think Salinas has been in critical overdraft. In fact, the State Water Board held a special hearing in the 90s to...
You might be thinking of Pajaro. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, I'm thinking of the Salinas groundwater basin with saltwater intrusion along the coast, like under Marina, where the State Board threatened adjudication in the 90s, and that's what created the Castroville project. So the Salinas Basin, I believe, is currently recognized as critical overdraft, and the Pajaro may be another one.
Okay, so I hear a little bit of confusion that maybe Salinas, maybe Pajaro, but I don't hear certainty, and I think it would be helpful for the board to know.
I'll get you the map.
You're looking at the maps online.
There's another one.
Okay, that's great. So I think it'd just be a good thing for us to know. And then you had a lot of discussion that I appreciated about the wetlands and how you're part of an effort coordinating with San Diego and others for a net gain wetland program, which I think is fantastic. And I know that in this area, we've had at least isolated projects that are trying to provide wetlands where none have existed recently. And so, not so much a question for you, Mr. Moore, but I wonder if in the future, our Central Coast staff could discuss the consistency or not that exists between this initiative you've described and the work that our regional staff are already doing, because it kind of sounded like the gist of your message was that enforcement and all the things we're already doing are critical, but the actual creation of additional wetland acres would sort of be where the rubber hits the road, and that's what we really are after, so let's get to it more ambitiously. That's kind of how I understood what you're saying. And I wanted to make sure that our staff and our board understood the ramification of doing that within our area, because probably a lot of us would like to create more wetland acres, and that takes time and staff and focus. And our focus, as you mentioned, in the state board staff is already spread so thin. So I just like in the future to have some discussion by our board about what potential, what opportunities there are for our board to be part of that initiative and what we're already doing, so that it's not like, oh, we don't get that. We haven't been involved with that in the past. Probably we are to the extent that we can, and we would need more funding or staff to be more involved. So I'd like to have that discussion with our board at some point and our staff.
If I may answer partially, is that, you know, I'm representing our regional water board in that particular initiative. So I'm part of a monthly conference call with all the other regions. We do have our staff, Lisa McCain, who has been assigned as being also our staff representative. In fact, she will be going with me to Sacramento on Monday, Sunday, for a Monday meeting. So I think we're pretty well engaged. I would suggest also, for the sake of this meeting, is that this is a topic that you certainly can bring up tomorrow as a follow-up to our strategic plan, because I think it fits, you know, a little bit more logically in getting your input and suggestions for that. Okay. And Mr. Johnston.
Thank you, Dr. Wolf. Just a couple of quick comments. I certainly don't want to start a whole new discussion. In terms of the colloquy between Board Member Young and Mr. Moore around the question of toxic algae blooms and the role that regional boards can play in that. There's a whole bunch of factors, as I've been learning, because I've got a toxic algae lake in my backyard. Among them are nutrient inputs, which can be anything from agricultural chemicals to septic system discharges to, in the case of Pinto Lake, erosion of phosphate-rich soil, all of which are things that we have tools to deal with. The other thing that has been cropping up a lot in terms of this being something that's been accelerating recently, and I've seen it both in terms of the Klamath and in terms of Pinto Lake, has been temperature. The warmer temperatures tend to allow the microcystis in particular to compete more effectively with the other algaes, and we're going to see more of that. But we have lots of tools to regulate those things, in terms of it's not just a question of flow, but as we do TMDLs on stream temperatures, as we do TMDLs that have to do with sediment loads. Those are all things that are, we're, as board member, as Mr. Moore said, we're, kind of the first line of laying out our approach is TMDLs, but we have a lot of different levers to pull on that. And it is going to be an increasing problem with climate change because of the temperature component, but as we've discussed a lot here, in the TMDLs in different reaches of the Salinas Valley, for example, we have some ability to deal with questions like temperature as well.
Thank you.
And I wanted to hear from Mr. Moore that we expect rain this winter.
We're planning in case, we're trying to follow Board Member Young's advice and assume there won't be any and plan accordingly.
Well, you know, Mr. Moore, for the record, is that last week, a weekend ago, I had an event at my vineyard, with about 84 people at lunch in the vineyard. And at the end, and we had an Italian accordion player, played a little bit of music, I suggested tongue-in-cheek to all the guests to get up and do a little bit of a rain dance, which they did, Italian style. And I want you to know that the following day, we had 1.5 inch of rain here in San Luis Obispo. So my services are available. But on a more serious note, you know, when we talk about the, you know, the drought and you know, what do we do about it, as, you know, Mr. Young mentioned, I see this very simply. 30,000 foot elevation, a three-legged stool. It's water augmentation, water conservation, and innovation. Right? I think that's what it boils down to. In regard to, you know, comments on agriculture, I think there is progress being made because, for example, you know, the use of overhead sprinklers are used for seed germination, and because you cannot germinate seeds using tape irrigation. There is a trend to switch to nursery-grown seedlings, and then you plant the seedlings, which then reduce the amount of overhead sprinkler time, and you can move into drip tape pretty quickly. So I think that's one change that we see. In fact, there's an increasing amount of nurseries now that have been expanding their service to provide the seedlings. So that's one area. Another one is that this year there's been miles and miles of retrofits of tape irrigations, you know, that are being utilized. There's also quite a bit of a trend in looking at subsurface drip irrigation. And then when we talk about the innovation side, is increasingly the use of local weather station to provide accurate ET data, you know, evapotranspiration, which is a much more scientific way to know how much you irrigate. So I agree there's a lot of progress that can be made, and sometime if, you know, you see 20 miles an hour wind, middle of the day, and overhead sprinkler, yes, there's quite a bit of waste, and maybe the timing of the use of the overhead sprinkler could be improved. There's also efforts now to perform irrigation at nighttime because you significantly reduce the evaporation part. So, you know, my view is that this has been a bit of a, well, not a bit, it has been a major wake-up call. But it takes a tremendous amount of effort to move all that inertia, you know, of also legacy of habits of how you farmed in the past. But I see progress. Yeah.
You know, an interesting thing that I learned about drip irrigation, and it's counterintuitive, and it hurts us during the drought, is that drip can maintain a soil moisture content, but if the soil gets dry, it cannot compensate for that. You have to go to something like spray. And so actually what you may see if the drought continues is more spray, not less, because the soil gets so dry. And I think gardeners are probably, I know I am at home finding that same issue, is I've had to turn off the drip and go to just using a hose because it doesn't supply enough water any longer. The soil has become so dry.
Yes, Ms. Johnson.
Just a quick answer to Mr. Delgado's question. The two groundwater basins in our region that were identified as being in critical overdraft in the 1980 DWR report were the Cuyama Valley Basin in Santa Barbara County and the Santa Cruz Pajaro Basin.
All right, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your very comprehensive report.